Jeff H.
My name is Jeff, and I'm an addict in recovery. And I'd like to thank my higher power and the program of Narcotics Anonymous and you people for keeping me clean and relatively serene. And if I was to stand here and tell y'all that I'm not nervous, I'd be lying. So I'm going to tell you that straight up, that anytime I stand up in front of a group of people to try and share my experience, strength, and hope, I get a little antsy because I want to give this thing back to you, you know, in the spirit of love and care that it was given to me. I got this way, you know, over a quarter of a century ago, you know, because I had a problem with acceptance. And that problem with acceptance stemmed from my lack of acceptance for myself and who I was. You know, I grew up in a family of 15. I had 14 brothers and sisters, and so I had a whole lot of role models, you know, in terms of what to be like and what not to be like, you know. And it was a lot of love in that family, you know, and gotta try to get relaxed here. But, you know, I never accepted myself for who I truly was, and so consequently I did a lot of pretending, you know. I pretended to be a lot of people who I really wasn't, and, you know, and when I couldn't realize those people who I tried to be, I had to find some other way to make me change the way I feel, or the way I felt. So early on, I picked up a cigarette and tried to make myself dizzy, and it made me dizzy, you know. And I remember early on, you know, I gotta qualify myself real quick, briefly. You know, I'm the offspring of a couple of parents who were considered to be alcoholics. And alcohol is a drug, make no mistake about it. It had the same compulsive and insidious characteristics that narcotics afforded me. Anyway, you know, my mother was one of those people that I felt real ashamed of early on because, you know, coming up in my neighborhood, women didn't drink to get drunk. They just drank to kind of be social, you know. But my mom, I guess, was going through a lot more than some of the other mothers in the neighborhood. And so being a single mother, she kind of took things to excess at times. And my father, you know, he also was an alcoholic, and but he was one of those what you call functional alcoholics because, you know, I never saw him tipsy, you know what I mean, or looking like he was slightly out of control or anything. And plus he had a job, you know. But at age 13, I lost my father. My father was killed, and that was the year that I believe I became a man. I was a little boy becoming a man. You know, real quickly I had to learn to do some things without the leadership that I was accustomed to having. And a lot of times I felt lost. A lot of times I felt helpless. And a lot of times I felt hopeless. And a lot of times I felt useless because I couldn't function like the stronger members of my family did, you know. I always needed to have somebody to kind of lean on. And at that time, I mostly leaned on my mom, you know. And for somebody who really made me feel ashamed. You know, I really, really counted on my mother for my upkeep. And I didn't realize how much I really, really counted on her until she was gone 10 years after my father died. And once again, I felt abandoned, you know. But let me get back to my problem. My problem was drugs and alcohol. My problem was becoming an addict. This workshop, I'm going to try to stay on task and stay on topic as best I possibly can, because I think it's important. This workshop is called NA is Not My Whole Life, But It Made My Life Whole. I think this is a real appropriate workshop for me to be doing because for a long time, you know, I did a lot of meetings on a daily basis, sometimes 3-4 times a day, consistently, because I wanted to stay clean and I wanted this thing, you know, like people crave for air and water. And the way I got here, to share a little bit about my experience, strength, and hope, try to give you a little idea of what it was like before I got here and what got me here and what it's like now. As my sponsor always said, keep it real simple, Jeffrey, you know. And so what happened is that at age 13, I decided, you know, that I had to do something to change my mood. So at my father's funeral, at Stewart Funeral Home, my cousin and I went out the back door and smoked a joint, you know. And that just led me on, man. You know, I had toyed with the idea of getting high, you know, and I always looked around and said that I saw people who I didn't want to be like, and I said that I would never be like those people. But as God is my witness, I became exactly like those people. Because that one joint led to a whole slew of different mind and mood altering chemicals. So, you know, I started off with a cigarette, you know. And from there, I went on to drinking and smoking and experimenting with chemicals. I smoked PCP. At some point, you know, along the line, somebody introduced me to a drug called cocaine. Around that time, I was a young man. I think I had just become ready to graduate from college. And I got to share you a little bit about the kind of environment that I came up in as well, you know, because getting high was something that everybody did kind of like second nature, you know what I'm saying? It was no thing to see somebody, you know, standing on the corner smoking a joint. And a lot of times, me and my friends, you know, we did these things to excess, you know. I remember developing a high tolerance for chemicals because when I was, I think I was like 16 years old, and I had my first summer job. Me and my friends, we got our first summer job check, and we bought 2/5 of alcohol. And everybody started getting drunk, and we were trying to go to the Go-Go down on F Street. And a lot of those guys didn't make it, but I took several of them home, and I realized then that I had a real high tolerance for alcohol, you know, because I didn't pass out or anything like that, you know, and we killed 2/5, you know what I'm saying? Well, anyway, I mentioned to you that I had a self-esteem problem. I had a problem with feelings of inadequacy. I was the smallest member of my family, the men in my family at the time. My brothers were 6'2", you know, and we were very athletically built and everything, but they had a lot of street sense, and they had a lot of survival skills that I didn't possess, and consequently, people kind of took advantage of my kindness, you know, and it made me feel real bad when I realized that that had happened. I remember pretending a lot, too, you know. I remember pretending to have a girlfriend. You know, I was in love with this girl in high school, and, you know, I didn't have the heart to go up to her and talk to her and stuff, so I kind of pretended that we was already together. You know what I'm saying? You know? And, you know, later on I found out that this young lady, you know, she kind of craved my company as well as I craved her. She said, well, you know, if you'd have just came up to speak to me, you know, I kind of liked you too. I was like, well, damn. Damn, man. I wish I'd have known. You know? So, you know, we drank and drug, man, for a long time, man. You know, I remember, man, going off. You know, my brothers were living on the wrong side of the law, you know, and I was the one in the family where they decided that I was going to be something. You know what I'm saying? Because what had happened, see, I was an extremist. You know, what had happened in high school is that I had skipped English class requirement for like 4 years straight. You know what I mean? And when I got in the 12th grade, they told me that I wasn't going to graduate unless I had all of those four-year requirements of English. So I was like, whoa, damn, how am I going to do this? You know, I was really, really overwhelmed by this. You know, I came up in a family, man, where, you know, studying in the house wasn't one of those things that we did real readily. You know what I'm saying? We did what we was told around the house, and then we hit the street, you know. So I had made a decision that I was going to really try to study and get out of high school, man. And so I set up, a program with my counselors so that I could make up all four of those English classes from 9th grade all the way through 12th grade, along with taking all of the requirements that I had presently for that 12th grade year. And I was doing pretty well, man, but I was going crazy, man. I was really under a lot of stress and stuff, and I was getting high, too, you know. And one of my buddies came home from Lawton and told me, he said, man, he said, why are you stressing so much, Jeff? I said, because I'm about to self-destruct. I said, I don't know how I'm going to make this, man, you know, but everybody else is going to move on, and once again, I'm going to be left behind. And he told me, he said, Jeffrey, he said, man, you was probably one of the brightest dudes, man, that came up in our crew. He said, and I went to jail, man, and I took the GED test, and I passed it. He said, and if I could pass this thing, I know you can too. He said, why don't you go ahead and take the test and see if you can pass? And if you don't, because, see, I had this fear. I didn't want to go and have to enroll in a GED program. I thought that it was going to really make, you know, my image suffer, you know. So I said, I'll give this a try, man. And he said, if you fail, then you just got to go sign up for the program. So, okay, so I went and passed the test. Before I knew it, man, you know, these folks was having me going off to college and everything else. And then along the way, I have to say that my high school also told me, yeah, by the way, you was getting ready to graduate, too. You did okay. I was like, damn. You know, I must be all right. You know, I'm going to go celebrate. So, of course, you know how I celebrated, right? Went on, got high. And that period led to a run, man, that lasted for over 25 years, man. You know. And it ended up in an alley off of on the street about a few blocks away from where I lived. And the last thing that I remember was having this young lady pull a blade out on me and telling me that if I drank the last drop out of that bottle, she was going to cut my you-know-what throat. And this was a young lady that I had started treating that night. I thought I was going to trick with her, y'all. But the crack cocaine had other ideas, you know. And so I wound up, you know, drinking out of the bottle of this wino. And I said to myself, here I go once again, doing something that I said I was not going to do. You know, my life, man, was a series of ups and downs and crazy turnarounds. And it's still like that much today. But today, I feel like my life is much different and a lot more whole than it was then. Because today, you know, I don't use to live and live to use. You know, I live to try and make a difference. You know, try to do something for somebody, you know, like things was done so freely for me, you know. And a lot of times I fall short, you know. I came around here in October 1993. And as I mentioned to you, I have had a series of ups and downs and crazy turnarounds, you know. In my first year, I went in treatment because them youngins was chasing me with them bats. And I was one of them dudes, I think I must have been suicidal or something, because I didn't care about dying. I really didn't. I remember thinking, well, if I go out, see, I thought I was a warrior. I said, if I go out, I'm going out like a soldier, you know. I'm not going out like no sucker. And, you know, as scared as I was, you know, I was prepared to die, man. I really was. And them youngins was prepared to kill me. And what happened, my sister heard of my misfortune. And she told me, she said, Jeffrey, she said, I'ma let you stay up in my basement for this weekend. Because I don't, you know, you looking real bad. You know, every time I see you, you got a different knot on your head. You know, and you ain't doing so well, you know. And I used to always say, well, I'd be doing all right if y'all just leave me alone and let me do what I got to do, because I can handle this, you know what I'm saying? But people always getting in the way of my getting high, you know, or getting in the way of my manageability, you know. So she said, I'll let you stay in my basement this weekend, but the deal is, after this weekend, you got to go in treatment. And I was like, treatment? I don't need no treatment. All I need is a place to chill, get my head together, and I'll be all right. I'll start all over fresh. And she said, okay, but come Monday, you got a decision to make. And before that weekend was over with, I used, man. And that's when I wound up in that alley off of 1st and Old Street, right behind Hanover. I had started out, you know, one of my buddies asked me to let him sneak in there and cut up his product and bag it up. And he had a way of giving me all of the leftover crumbs. And he used to give me a lot of crumbs. And I used to say, you know, and he used to tell me, he said, man, now go make you some money, Jeff. And I said, I'm going to do this. You know what I'm saying? Well, that's how I started out. But I ended up in the alley, man, you know, drinking the spit out of that man's bottle, man. You know what I mean? And so come Monday, I wound up in treatment. That's how I was before I got here, man, you know. A lot of things happened in between. People put pistols in my face, you know. People put the bat on me, you know what I'm saying. Females got out on me. You know, I remember I had a job doing some AV work, you know, and I had to be at a place You know, I was a freelancer, and I had to be at a certain place at a certain time, you know, or else the show didn't go on. And I wasn't in that place. I was running around the neighborhood trying to find this girl because she had stole my wallet, you know, when I fell asleep. That was one of those times where I actually scored because she found out I had a lot of money, and she took off with it. And, man, you know, I just thank God I don't have to live that way no more, man, you know, because I'd start out and say, well, I'm just going to use a little bit, and then I'm gonna sell the rest, you know. And I start out that way every time, and I say, and my disease would be talking to me, and it would say, look here, man, you know, it's cunning, and it's baffling. Because what's so cunning about it is that here it has damn near ruined my life, but it will convince me that if I just do it another way, I'd be all right. And I used to say, man, you know, I remember, you know, consciously telling myself if I could just get high, if I didn't get high with Barbecue Bill, I was one of my best friends. We called him Barbecue Bill because he tried to barbecue some food out in the backyard and burned up the whole damn house. And that's how we remember him. He's one of my best friends. But he was one of those guys that was a real good hustler. He's still to this day, goes in and out of prison. In and out all his life. And he's one of those habitual shoplifters, you know. And what he would do is he would come home and start shoplifting and steal just enough stuff to go get high, and then he'd come and get me and crumb me to death. You know, just make my life truly, can I curse, fucking miserable. God forgive me. I love that brother today though, man. You know, because I knew he meant no harm, but he just did what he do. You know, and I used to tell myself, I said, well, if I just stop volunteering the fact that I got something to the wrong people, if I just go in the house and quietly get high, not stick my head out the window and mess with everybody, not hook my guitar up to the amplified and crank up loud enough so they can hear me all the way down the street, not turn my radio on and start DJing so they can hear me, I'd be all right. But it never happened like that, because, see, I had a hole in my soul, man, that I tried to fill with all the wrong things, you know. And consequently what happened, man, is that I wound up just where I started out at every time, you know. But N.A. was introduced to me, man, like I said, 11 years ago, in October, you know, and I wound up, somebody gave me a program. Somebody said, go in here and detox. And here's the same place that my brother had a cleaning contract, cleaning up, you know, and he had just come back down from New York. He had lived up in the Bronx for about 10 years. You know, and he come back. He was one of those guys that always knew how to get a contract, you know. So he had this cleaning contract, and that was my first introduction to detox, because I used to clean up at D.C. General Detox and Mary Heron Home, right? And I remember a lady, I ain't going to break her anonymity, but she's very well known, man, and I remember this lady was the only person staying in Mary Herring Home in the summertime. Everybody else was gone. And she didn't have no place else to go. So they allowed her to stay there. And she's still around. And I got a lot of hope, you know, when I met this lady, man. I never knew that I'd wind up, you know, in recovery with her. But I know my time is running short, so I better wind it up. I wound up going in detox, spent 7 days. I came out of detox. I was cured. I told them, I don't need to go into no program. And they tricked me. They scared me into the 28-day program. They said, well, look. I think my brother called him up and told him, say, well, look, give him an offer. If he refuses, take it away and see what happens. And the guy took the offer away. He said, I got a bed for you. I talked to your brother. I got a bed for you. If you take this bed, you'll be all right, or you can go back to your misery. And I said, I don't need that, man. I'm all right. And then when I found out that everybody else was, you know, opting to try to get some help, I asked him about that bed, and he said, I got your bed, man. I just wanted to see how you was going to act. So after that, I went into a six-month program, and they wanted to kick me out of the six-month program for smoking a cigarette in the house. And I thought I was going to die, man, if they sent me back to my old environment. So I did all the things that they demanded of me in order to get back in good standing. And I wound up moving on to a further recovery environment, and I stayed there for 5 years. And I remember telling myself that I don't want to be like some of these treatment bums. I'm a very independent person. I've always been an independent minded person, at least I thought. What I was really was a person running on self will. You know, I didn't want structure. I mean, I didn't want nobody to instruct me how to live. I wanted to show them that I knew how to live. But anyway, it was a guy there that had been there for 5 years. He was a senior man in the house. He was a Vietnam veteran. And I said to myself, I said, wait a minute. And at some point, this guy had a lot of discipline to make it home from Vietnam. So he can't be all that bad. So maybe I'm going to stick around and try to see how this thing works. And I stayed there, man. And somebody told me, they said, this is not a nesting place. This is a resting place. You come here, try to get yourself together, try to establish a foundation, maybe save up a little something to help you along, and then you move on and try to live one day at a time out there in society. And I kind of did that, man, and, you know, I wound up leaving there and got myself an apartment paying $200-something more than what I was paying there. And my friends who were living in that establishment was like, man, why are you leaving, man? You gonna pay $200-something more for the same space? Well, I don't get it. I said, man, you know, I got to step out on faith. I got to get out here, man, and see how they living in the real world. And I did that. And that was 5 years ago, and now I own my own home. You know what I mean? Thank you. Not through my own efforts, through God, you people in this program. You know, NA is not my whole life, but it's made my life whole. And the reason I can say that is because a lot of y'all don't see me that much. I'm one of the members of the seldom seen, but I know how important the program of recovery is. I know how important step work is. I know how important sponsorship is. Because I remember when I first came out of treatment, and my man Khalil just gave me the sign, my sponsor who I met, I told him, I said, I need a sponsor to get into the transition program. He said, well, I can't be your sponsor. He said, but I'll be your friend. I'll temporarily sponsor you until you can find somebody else who can help you through the long haul. But he's been my sponsor ever since. And I ain't letting him go. You know, he's had a lot of medical problems, so he doesn't get around as much as he'd like to and as much as I would like to. But we've come down here to this convention on a number of occasions together, and we stay in touch. And he's introduced me to other members of this program and the fellowship, and it's been all good, man. You know, I wouldn't trade this thing for no amount of money in the world. I really wouldn't. I didn't know anything about life on life's terms until I got the program of Narcotics Anonymous. And I ain't got this thing, but I'm getting it. You know what I'm saying? And I believe that the longer I stick around, the more I'll get. So I want to thank y'all, man, you know, for allowing me the privilege of standing before you and sharing my experience, strength, and hope. And just remember, for the newcomer, man, if a guy like me can get this thing, you can too. There's a lot of folks out here that I look to for support and for encouragement. I want to thank y'all for coming out and supporting me in my first workshop, man, you know. A lot of y'all, I see you, man, you know, and I saw the glow of recovery in you before I decided to give this thing a determined and persistent trial. And I'm happy to say it's been a blessing and a wonderful journey, and I'll keep coming back. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for sharing. Now I'd like to introduce our second speaker, and his name is Ron G.
Who did it? I smoke boat, don't y'all do that stuff. I'm Ron, I'm an addict.
Hey, Ron.
Man, if y'all, I had a meeting in my head over the last couple of weeks, man. If y'all had heard all that profound stuff I came up with, y'all would be so happy with my shame. Y'all ain't gonna hear none of that today because I can't remember nothing I thought of, right? Okay, y'all, mics are dangerous for me. I want to sing. Yeah, I always fantasize about being like a star or something, singing, so I get a mic.
If this isn't true.
First, I need to apologize. I enjoy recovery. I really enjoy being clean. First, I'm Ron G. My home group is a Yellow Brick Road group at VA Hospital. 8 o'clock Friday night, we're recovering our butt off. My clean date, March 23rd, 1989. And just for the qualifying part, I grew up in one of the real nice neighborhoods in Washington, a place called Burry Farms. It was one of the better places to raise a young black man. I grew up thinking I had a wonderful life until I was a kid. I started getting high at a real young age. I remember my first drug. It was spinning. Yeah, we get out in the yard and we just spin around. You know. Fall out. Most kids do it 4 or 5 times. Go in the house. My mother had to come and get me about 9 o'clock. I'm still spinning, man. I didn't think it was a problem. I grew up playing nice games, neighborhood games, you know, throw rocks at the police. Y'all laughing. This is real, I'm telling you. In our neighborhood, we had the biggest playground in the metropolitan area. We used to break into St. Elizabeth Mental Institution. We did. We'd break in through the back gate and go up to the Civil War graveyard and throw rocks at the graveyard and see if they chase us. They don't chase you. It was fun. I really loved my neighborhood growing up. In my neighborhood, there was some things going on that I kind of knew they wasn't right, but they seemed to fit, you know, like bootlegging, drug dealing, card parties, you know, all that kind of stuff. That was norm for me. So I started out using because I felt inadequate. And I'm going to tell you right now, I feel a little... Y'all want me? I'm not speaking loud enough. Y'all can't hear me. How about if I act like I was something? I got a good hitting, holding by the scratch, tickling like Popeye chicken. Pass me by you. Get high. Yeah. Yeah, okay. I bet if I said I got half, you trying to go half, y'all. But I guess I'm not speaking loud because my character has changed. Because I grew up as a loud, obnoxious kid. I mean, you know, part of the society I come from. And it was all right, but NA has changed my life. I'm a different person, and I know I am. I know I'm different because I haven't cursed yet. And it ain't that I got anything against cursing. Y'all just change people. I like cursing. So if I curse and say something that offends somebody, I'm sorry. I ain't even going to say fuck you. I'm just going to say I'm sorry. But when I was a kid, I felt real inadequate because in my neighborhood, they fought all the people. I don't like fighting. I can say it now. I couldn't say it then. I did not like getting hit in the face. You see how cute I am, so I mean I had a problem. Why you laugh so hard? You think I'm that ugly? But I didn't like it, and you had to fight. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a thing where you could say, no, that's okay. I mean, yeah, if you didn't fight, they'd take it every day, you know. And we was in the projects. It ain't like I had a lot for you to take, so, you know, I had to fight, man, and I didn't like it. But, you know, I learned to fight, and I got beat up a lot. And I beat up a few guys. A girl beat me up one day. That was real embarrassing, man. Man, hey, that girl beat me up, man. It was snow on the ground, and she threw a snowball and hit me in the back. This was at school, and I jumped on the rail to slide down like a cool dude. But it was snow on the ground. I hit the ground. I fell on the ground. She jumped on me and tore my butt up, man. Man, I had to
stepping on some toes.
Man, I had to fight hard after that, you know, because they talk about stuff like that. But because I felt that way, one day a guy who was my best friend named Pee Wee, he's dead now, came to me with a little capsule, right? And he said, this is what them older guys use that make them so cool. Because in my neighborhood, when you poor, you find ways and means to be cool. You know, like we didn't have good clothes, so we would cut our jeans at an angle because we couldn't afford to get them cuffed.
Yeah.
And then let them get ragged at the bottom, and that was fashionable. You know. People buy jeans like that now with holes in them. Stupid, right? You know, we had our collars up, shirt buttoned down to here and stuff like that. We had no hair on our chest because we were baby punks. But, you know, wear hats cocked and all that kind. It was cool and stuff, but it was guys, they had a walk that they used to call the pimp. Now, there weren't no pimps around, there weren't no hoes, but it was a walk. I ain't doing that walk, man. I used to practice that in the house. I would practice that because you go up and down, like, you know, your head going like this. It's a cool walk. It was. Steve, you remember, I used to do it. It's a cool walk, right? And I, when you know, the big boys would do that, and I wanted to be cool like them, man. I'd be in the house with my collar up, walking through the living room, pimping and stuff. And when he gave me this little pill, first I said, well, give it here so I can be cool. One pill, cool for life. That's a great deal, right? And he said, no, you only get half of it. Now, I don't know how you get half a capsule, but he separated and gave me half. And I went to swallow it. He said, you don't swallow it. So what the hell is you going to do with medicine? But, you know, he said, you put it up your nose. So I put the half a capsule up my nose. Later on, I thought he was supposed to take the powder part out. I was learning, right? And instantly when I put that thing in my nose, I started thinking, now I'm cool. Now, here's the point. This is psychological, right? I learned this later on by doing step work. Because I put that thing in my nose and I believed what he said, I felt different. The drugs had not taken effect, but the addiction was starting its course. You know what I'm telling you now? It wasn't the drugs. It was in my head. It was in my mind. So later on, when I started throwing up and stuff, I said, man, ain't no way, never again. I hate this, it's miserable. But after that stop, oh, man, I was a real pimp. I was a player, man. I ain't had no money, you know what I'm saying? A little boy, I think I was probably about 12 years old. You know, I had tennis shoes, them old Converses and stuff. We call them Chuck Taylors with the star on the inside and stuff, and cheap jeans because we couldn't afford real Lees. But, man, I was on top of the world because of the way that stuff made me feel. So I wanted some more. And that's what I did. I started getting more because every time I got it, it made me feel like a cool dude. And I learned to pimp on the streets. And the girls stopped beating me up. For real. Because I wasn't around no girls.
Yeah.
I didn't need anybody to beat me up, man. Addiction was getting ready to do a real whipping on my head. But that was the beginning. And it was okay at the beginning because it was like I could go to my mother and get 50 Cent and Pee Wee could get 50 Cent and we could get high. Mm-hmm. And even when it got up to the point that I needed $5, you know, I could get $5 and stay high for 2-3 days sometimes. And then for a couple of days, I wouldn't even want anything. I'd be okay. Let me tell you about the end, right? Because I know an old guy told me once that when you share in a meeting, you should always talk a little bit about that addiction that you use in part for identity. Because a lot of, if I just get into how it is now, some of you new people may not understand that who I really am, right? But on the last day that I used, I walked from Clinton, Maryland to Washington, D.C. with no money in my pocket. And I did that because my wife had scheduled me to go into drug treatment the next day at the VA hospital, right? And I had to get that last one on that was going to carry me till I got out of treatment so I could get the next one on. Because I wasn't going to treatment to get clean and stay clean. I was going to keep from getting put out, right? And I walked to D.C. that day with no money. I met a wino behind a 7-Eleven that used to be on Alabama Avenue in Southeast and persuaded him to take me to my mother's job on the promise I was going to give him $10. Now, I tell you, I ain't got no money, but I'm a dope fiend, so I lie real well. And he took me over there, and I went into school where my mother worked, low crawled past the office and walked into her classroom because I knew that was the way to get what I wanted. Because when I walk in her room, the kids get quiet because Junkie Man in the door. And yeah, little kids are scared of junkies. You go back out, you can take the kids' money. Right? I told on myself. Yeah, I took some kids' money. So what? I'm a junkie. And my mother would always come to me immediately when I walked in her door and say, "What do you want? Why are you here?" And I told her that day, I said, "I needed to go to the clinic and my car broke down and stuff," my wife had took the keys because she didn't want me to go kill myself. My mother let me use her car under the auspices. auspices. That is not a Bird Farms word. Yeah. Anyway, she let me use the car under the auspices that I would be back by 3 so she could get home. And I took her car and I went, well, let me tell you this, as Junkie Man, part of my job responsibilities was to monitor paydays. I ain't had no job, so my job. Yeah, that's right. Steve got paid every 2 weeks on Friday. And this day, a friend of mine was getting paid, and I knew it, and I had to get there before another superhero got there. Because I was like his sponsor, right? I went to his job, and I walked in, and he made me so proud, because he had a government job, you know, and stuff. And he had on a tie and a suit, and he had a folder in his hand like this thing right here, man, and stuff. And he was talking to these two ladies, and he was, like, giving directions. Have these files taken to my office, and take this to Mr. Brown about 3:30. I want to meet him. I mean, I was like, that's my boy. He sounds professional, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's who I want to see. He get paid today. And he looked over. He gave the lady the phone. He turned and looked and saw me in the doorway, and he turned into a junkie man. Because he looked right at me and all that professional government stuff. He said, "My mama, man." When he said that, I knew I'm on. I'm on. Got him, right? So he said, I don't know why, but he asked me, "What you doing over here?" So I told him the truth. Well, I was just passing by. I thought I'd stop by and holler at you, right? He said, "Man, you right on time. It's payday." What? Now, for some of you people who don't understand what they're laughing at, the people who are laughing have done this. That's yeah. I wasn't the only superhero out there. Anyway, we took our check and went. Yeah. And we went and cashed our check. Well, he cashed our check and came back out with our money. And we went to the strip. Now, at this time, I was what you call in bad standings with some of the more prominent drug dealers. So there wasn't a lot of places I could go. So I went back to my home group, Talbot Street. And on Talbot Street, you know, I was a regular member. That was my home group. You know, I know everybody in service from around there. Everybody. Right. So,
yeah.
By me being the senior addict, I copped because he's my friend, and I talked. Let me cop because they might beat you, right? We look out for our friends. So after I got our dope, I got back in the car and we went back to the house and to his house. I didn't have a house. and senior addict as I am, I fixed the drugs up, right? And he's my friend and I care a lot about I'm a real good friend. So I made sure that he didn't get hurt, so I gave him a little extra water. Okay, I beat him. And he started nodding, and I ain't feel nothing, man. And he looked over at me and said, "What's wrong, man?" I said, "Man, I shot a miss or something. I shot dope, shot a miss. Some of y'all smoke crack. I use needles. I don't know about everything I know about crack. I learned from y'all talking about crawling on floors and stuff. I did not crawl on floors. I just faced them a lot." And because we were such good friends, he said, "Man, you got to get high." And so he took out some more of our money. And I made the run and let him stay home because he was high. He didn't need to be out on the street.
Yeah.
I'm the senior addict. I'll take care of this. Went back to my home strip, copped again, got back in the car, took the bags out that I got the dope with the first time, took half the dope out the bag that I just bought, put it in the bag. You shaking your head, yeah, you. Went back upstairs with the half of the dope that I had bought, hooked the dope up, gave him a water shot. He got higher. I don't know what. To this day, sometimes I think I was so messed up that I was beating myself. I'm so used to switching, I might have switched twice. I don't know what happened. But he kept getting high, and I did this like 3 or 4 times, man. And then at about 3:30, he looked up out of the nod, and I was looking at him thinking about, I should rob this nigga. Yeah, so he don't go get no more dope and hurt himself. And he started saying things that were, like, spiritual. He was giving me signs, like, "I was supposed to buy my daughter some shoes today. I'm supposed to get my clothes out the cleaners. Shit, I ain't got no money to get my wife for the grocery." In other words, "Ron, we ain't getting no more dope. You might as well leave." And it dawned on me, well, that's okay. He's my friend. I got all that dope in the car and beat him out of. And getting close to time for Mom to get off. And Mom live up the street from him, so I need to get out the neighborhood. And I drove to Clinton, right? I figured my mother really didn't need her car. She had a job. She could catch a cab. She should have money. She didn't need her car. So I drove to Clinton. And I went in the bathroom. And I'm going to tell you, that day we was using heroin and cocaine. So I went in the bathroom and I did all the dope that I had beat my good friend out of. Then I started cleaning behind the toilet. And up on top of the medicine cabinet, I cleaned the light bulb off. Okay, you know. I don't know why. Cocaine make me clean stuff. Right. And my wife started beating on the door, cursing and talking about, "You dirty, how could you leave your own mother stranded?" And she's stupid. She got a job. She don't need a car, you know. And eventually I came out of that bathroom with one thing on my mind. What the hell can I do to get another hit? It was like 7 o'clock. I've been using all day. And all I could think of, what can I do to get some more? The next day, she packed up a suitcase, took me up to the VA hospital, pulled up out front, walked upstairs to the treatment ward, told the big lady, she said, here he is, dropped the suitcase, walked out and shit. I found out at my 7th year anniversary, my wife planned to move while I was in treatment. She shared that at my, she said, I guess he can handle it now, I'll tell him. And that didn't hurt too much. What happened was when she told me, the kids said, yeah, we had packed up and everything. They just couldn't find sale for the house, so they were stuck with me. But that was where it began, because in treatment, I was introduced to you all. Now, I'm telling you, they had a lot of good things in treatment. Don't knock it. It's one, they detoxed me and stuff like that. I went to the window one day to get my meth. That's methadone. If you're clean, it's methadone. If you're using it, it's meth. Then I stand up on some street talk about methadone. Anyway, it's my story, it's real. They detoxed me. When I went to the window one day, the lady told me, asked me what I wanted. I said, I want my meth. And she said, Mr. Green, according to this, you haven't had any meth in 4 days. You've been getting a placebo. That's a beat bag in medical term. Dumb. Now, here's one of the more of those psychological addiction things. That day, I had played basketball. I had been walking up down the halls, laughing, joking, eating. Man, I was on top of the world. I'm in treatment. I'm doing this jail thing. I mean, this treatment thing. And the dude behind me looked at me and said, yeah, and act like you sick, nigga. Yeah, because I hadn't had any meth. And I didn't get a chance to whine and cry about detoxing because I didn't know. That psychological effect of addiction is so powerful, man, that it's the thing that tells us that we can't stop smoking. Yeah, smoking's a form of addiction, whether you know it or not. It's that because I'm afraid of how I'm going to feel. I stopped smoking right after my first year anniversary, and I can tell you exactly how I did it. I got in my car. It was a truck anyway, in my pickup truck. I was driving to a meeting, and I thought, I don't want to smoke no more because I've been hearing people talking about this. And I reached up, and I threw my cigarettes out the window. They was over the Sun Visor. Well, y'all keep them up there. Threw them out the window, and then I haven't smoked since.
All right.
That's it. You looking for some profound wisdom on all the idiosyncrasies you need to go through to stop smoking? If you want to stop smoking, don't pick up. Throw away the cigarettes. And I know some of y'all are mad at me now. I'm sorry. I got to give a clear message. Addiction is addiction. It ain't about the drugs. It's about a disease that controls our lives. Well, addiction had my life. I got clean. Now, let's talk about how NA is not my whole life. For the first 90 days, and I came out of treatment, I went to meetings every day, all day long. It was a little over 90 days. I got a sponsor who had a seasonal job who was off for like 3 months, and I went to his house every morning, and he would go take me to meeting after meeting. I mean, I was driving. We went to meetings in Baltimore. We went to Virginia, man. We went to Northwest. We went in Southern Maryland. We just went everywhere, just taking me to meetings, and he taught me some things. Like, if you go on a meeting and it's all the front seats are taken or something, go sit on the floor up front. And I was like, there's seats in the back. He said, you need to hear the message. Go sit on the floor up front. I said, man, what them people going to think? He said, they're going to think you practice some humility. Go sit up front. And I did that, man. And, you know, being a big old thug from Southeast, that's real cute. That's hot. I don't know why y'all laughing. I'm cute for real. That was difficult in the beginning. But later on, I began to understand that humility meant that I just thought a little less of myself. Well, I thought of myself less. I didn't think any less of myself. But that I stopped making me the priority of the world, you know. And anyway, I started doing those things, going to meetings regular, and I loved it. Man, I love go to meetings, free coffee. Some of y'all get donuts, cookies, stuff like that. Pretty women come up, hug me and stuff. People share, tell them stories that's so interesting, you know what I'm saying? But especially crack people was coming in and was, you know, just crack people had stories like, you know, I smoked a pipe and look out the window, because somebody, I knew somebody was coming in. Yeah, you know, because it's dangerous up here on the 14th floor. And it's, I was like, yeah. Tell me some more of that crazy, because I shoot dope. You don't worry about nobody coming in. That's all it is, you know. You know, let somebody play some music, then you can do this with your hands. Yeah. That's heroin, baby. Ain't no whole lot to it. Just don't know nothing, don't care about nothing. That's all.
By going to so many meetings and liking it so much, I became addicted to meetings. That's all I wanted to do is go to meetings. Man, you know, I can't wait till I get up front. I want to share. I want to tell my story, right? I remember the first time my sponsor had me lead a meeting. I got up front, and I was so scared. I just looked at him. I said, I don't know what to say. They said, what was it like? It was rough. They said, what happened? I went to treatment. What's it like now? Oh, man, I go to meetings every day and stuff like that. I got a sponsor. He told me to get a basic text. I'll be reading the first three steps every day and stuff like that. I like the coffee, man. There'd be some women in here. They fat. You know, I could talk about what it's like, then, you know, but I had to learn how to share my story. I learned how to share my story by listening to other people share their stories. I didn't read it somewhere. I paid attention, right? But it got so good till that's all I wanted to do. But the same wife who committed me to that mental institution started saying things like, you know, you going to all them meetings every day. Ain't nobody cutting the grass. You coming in every night. You eat up everything that's left, you know. You get up in the morning, you're gone before I wake up. I ain't getting no sex, you know, which I wasn't giving no sex when I was using. I don't want you mad about it. You know, and you just, it's like, you know, you come in, you go to bed, you get up, you leave again. You need to start participating around the house. Okay. So I told my sponsor something wrong with my wife. Y'all did that too. Come on. Y'all know everybody else is the problem. And what happened was he told me she's right. He said, in the beginning, you should make NA your life. He said, but after that, you need to start branching out and taking some of the principles that you gain and start using them in the real world. So I got a job. I started stealing on the job. I got a couple other fellas in the fellowship come down and help me steal. We start sharing about it. Y'all beat us up in the meetings and stuff. So I stopped stealing off the job. I went back to school. I eventually started my own business. Let me tell you something real significant to me. One night I was on my way home. I had been to work that morning, went to a meeting, and I stopped at the 7-Eleven to get a Hostess cupcake and a scratch ticket. And I did something that I had never done before. I bought a loaf of bread. Now, at the time, I bought the bread because I wanted to have a sandwich when I went in the house because they wouldn't leave me much to eat. And I brought the bread home, and I made a couple of sandwiches, and I left it on the table. And I came out that morning. My wife said, where did bread come from? I said, I bought it. She said, you? So I stuck my chest up. Yeah. It dawned on me, yeah, I bought bread. And don't be eating it all either. You know what I'm saying? It's a slow process, y'all. It don't get better all at once. But that was the beginning, you know, and it felt so good till I started buying bread and milk and other groceries. And then I looked, I was cutting the grass and I was cleaning the cars. And I, man, one day I found myself opening the mail. I started paying bills. Man, look, my sponsor told me that I had a lot of free time. I need to go do some volunteer work somewhere. And I volunteered at this church. And I had so much time to, every day I would go up to this church and help out. One day the pastor asked me, he said, man, how much are you here? I said, I don't know, 5-6 days a week. He says, starting tomorrow, you're getting full pay with full benefits. You here more than I put. I still had that job, y'all. I've been on that job over 11 years, right? Right. Yeah, I'm a supervisor there now. I got full benefits and I love it. They're paying me to be here. It's called vacation. Annual leave.
Yes.
They don't talk about annual leave on Talbot Street.
No, sir.
Mm-mm. Only time off is jail time. That's that was it. But I got active in that church, and I found myself, for some reason now, every time somebody come in with a drug problem, they call me. Now, I work in the maintenance department. But they don't call the preachers, because they would call the preachers and the drug addict would always leave with a few dollars or something. One day a preacher said, "Ron, you know, but what can I do?" I said, "Don't give him no money." "Don't do nothing but come back again." Right? So it's like, you know, who was that guy? "He got a drug problem. Call Ron." You know what I'm saying? "I come around here with a mop. What do you want?" But let me tell you something. When those people show up at the church, I don't look down on them. I don't talk down to them. I don't belittle them. I treat them just like I treat them people who come in there Sunday with them real nice clothes on and all that old stuff. I treat them just like them bishops and pastors when they come in. I say, "Come on, man. Let's have something to eat." Yeah. See, I learned that from y'all. That's called character. Right? Yeah. Got that from y'all, right? And because of what you all have given me, my life, I go to maybe one meeting a day, 5 days a week now. I don't do 7 days, meetings all day anymore. I got a business to run. I got a family I'm responsible for. I got a job, right? But what you people have given me has allowed me to live this wholesome life outside of the meetings. There's nothing wrong with NA meetings. They're wonderful, life-saving information shared, but you can't hide in here. Can't do that. Our 12-step is based on charity and love. Yes, we'll love you to death. We will buy you food. We'll give you a few dollars for a couple of weeks. After that, that gets old. If you're new in this program, we have another direction we share. It's called job. Get a job. We say, you want to be a counselor? Go back to school. You like to ride? Buy a car. You like to eat? Get an income. I mean, this is what we do. We don't just, Narcotics Anonymous, we don't just go to meetings and talk good talk all the time, pick up clean time chips and celebrate anniversaries. Oh, man, as a member of Narcotics Anonymous, every now and then some preacher will come into my church and somebody wants to start a meeting in this group and he don't know nothing about it. And I'll tell him, man, I say, you need to understand, man, that our 12 steps is all based on God taking nothing, making something out of it. Okay? Don't knock the churches, y'all. Most of our meetings started in these places, right? But Khalil hit me on my leg and he gay, it was time for me to stop talking. But I love Narcotics Anonymous, man. And if you're not into the principle of this program, I dare y'all to try it, man. Thanks for letting me share.